The final examination in this course will, of course, cover the whole of the semester, I mean of the year. It will cover the two semesters that you've had. In case of people who have completed four semesters, it will cover all four. I don't think of anybody who has just received, will have just received credit for three semesters at the end of this semester. If there should be any such person, please give me a note or something very soon so I can prepare a special examination for you covering the three semesters that you've had. But in the case of the majority of the class, the examination will cover the two semesters. Now, there are very few who have not credit for any semester prior to the present one. And, of course, for those two, we will make a special definite arrangement so that they will have the same length of time, but all on this semester. But for most of you, it covers this semester, and it is important to have an idea of the progress of church history as it went from century to century. During the first century, we know very little about church history, aside from what's in the New Testament. What little there is, it is very important that we know. During the second century, during the first half, we know comparatively little. That comparatively little is very important. During the second half of the second century, we know considerably more. And that I hope you know, and know when it was for sure. When we come to the third century, we know a good deal more than that. It would be good for you to have a general idea of the part of the century, at least, in which anything happened during the third century. Then we come to the fourth, of which we know a tremendous lot. The fourth century, that is from 300 to 450, that century and a half, we know more about than any century of church history prior to the modern period. And it is more important than any century of church history, with the exception of the time of the Reformation probably. And so the events in that 300 to 450, that period, it would be well for you to have well in mind not only what they were, but the approximate time. I'm not greatly interested in precise dates. It doesn't make a great deal of difference whether you know that the Council of Nicaea was in 325 or whether you might think it's 323 or 328. But it makes a tremendous difference whether it's 325 or 225 or 425 or 625. And the purpose of the date is to place it approximately in relation to other events. And so when we're in a century like 300 to 450, when we have so many events, the dates become much more important proportionately because we know what the relationship of is of many more events. Whereas when you get into periods where we know less, if you know within a third of a century, it probably is quite adequate. And when you get into the Dark Ages, I lump that together. I hope that that period from 450 to about 900, that you will have a pretty good idea of developments during that period, though sometimes if you're a century off, it's not quite so important there. Then we, from about 1,000 on, I would certainly want you to know quite definitely about the 11th century, because it was a very, very important period. And then the 12th century, continuing the trends of the 11th century, developing them, certain new aspects. And then the 13th century, the extremely important century. The 13th century, there's a great deal of great importance about. The 14th century, not quite so important as the 13th century, represented a decline in the 1300s, a decline, the Babylonian captivity of the papacy, a time when the leaders of the church were giving themselves over to pleasures and losing the power that they had, which ended up with the debacle of the great schism, the end of the century. And then you come to the 15th century, the 1400s, which we're now looking at. A century which, from the viewpoint of great Christian writers, is not nearly as important as either of the previous three centuries, and far less important than the following century, which will take over a semester next fall. But a century which is a transition from the 1300s, the 1200s and 1300s, to the time of the Reformation, and therefore is very important to us. But a century in which, with all of the attitude that had developed that the church should be controlled by general councils, and that the council should reform the church, and the pope should simply be an executive officer, the pope, the council, get away with the schism and establish one pope who was recognized. And then the one pope and his successors, who were recognized, managed to do away with the strength of the councils, do away with holding councils altogether, and to get themselves established in a position different from any pope before. They gave themselves over to just as much pleasure as the popes of the 9th and 10th centuries had, or the Avignon pope. They tried to interfere in the situations in all of Europe the same way the popes of the 13th century had, perhaps not quite as extensively. But they did build up their power in Italy in a way that never had been built before. And they established their situation in Rome on a solid basis beyond what had ever done before. And they put the papacy on a situation that made it very different from what you really had in any previous century, and which is very important as background to the Reformation. And so in our last lecture, F was the strength of papacy, and we noticed under that head how the papacy now, under Martin V and Eugene IV, how they managed to break the power of the council. There were still people who felt the council was the supreme authority. But the council had become pretty much something out of date, something that no longer was even called into existence for nearly a century, and then only as an instrument of the papal purposes, and something that those who claimed that it could be so powerful were left without much real authority at all. While the popes are taking Rome that had fallen into such a condition of decay during the Babylonian captivity and during the schism, and are building it up with wonderful new buildings, getting the finest artists in the world to decorate these buildings, and building up a city that became like the city of ancient Rome, a city that in some ways was surely really the mistress of the world, and building up to the situation which Luther had to face in the next century. Then at the end of the hour last time, we mentioned a specific development of this 15th century, capital G, the humanist. And I mentioned to you that the word humanist is a word used in many different tenses in different periods. And it's sometimes used as humanist to mean one who deifies man, one who thinks that man is all that matters in the universe. Well, that is a comparatively recent use. You sometimes hear it used in that sense. We also hear the term natural used in that sense sometimes today. And then the term humanist is sometimes used for those who are interested in philanthropy, in being kind to human beings and developing human life. That's another sense, which is quite different from either the other common sense of today or the sense in which we use it speaking of the 15th century. But in the 15th century, it was a term which came to mean those who were interested in the greatest development of human spirit and human genius of past times. In other words, those who were interested in rediscovering the great secret of human wisdom that had been discovered by the Greeks and Romans in their tremendous civilization, a civilization which in some regards is superior to anything that the world has seen since. And these men were hunting through monasteries to find old manuscripts. And some of them began studying Greek, and they were interested in finding Greek manuscripts in addition to the Latin manuscripts that others were so eagerly finding and studying. And the fall of Constantinople in 1453 gave an impetus to this, in that some many individuals managed to escape from the Eastern Empire and to bring with them precious manuscripts to the West. And these manuscripts, if they brought them 2 or 3 centuries earlier, they either had to sell a manuscript to get a meal from. But now, there was such an interest in them that a man who had 2 or 3 valuable manuscripts could get a small fortune from for them and get himself well established in the West. And so, in the West, with civilization having advanced, the number of people who were literate having greatly grown, the number of universities rapidly increasing, wandering scholars going about through Europe where all scholars spoke the Latin language, and so it was easy to go from one country to another, engage in debate, put up subjects for theses which they would dispute with anyone who, with all comers, and that sort of thing. And the life of the intellect, of the general mass of people, not the mass perhaps, but of a very sizable number of people, was far advanced over what had been in previous centuries when the scholars mostly consisted of a comparatively few theologians, some of them, though, perhaps more brilliant than anyone who lived in this particular century. But the term humanism has come particularly to be applied to a group of men who might be considered as humanists also in the modern sense of being those who thought only of human things as being of importance, and who did not bother about divine things particularly. I read to you Poggio's account of Jerome's trial and martyrdom. And you notice how Jerome admired, how Poggio admired Jerome as a man, saw his brilliance in debate and his clearness of expression and his courage, and admired it and praised it. But every third sentence he would say, I don't say anything against, I don't praise him for anything contrary to what the church holds. I don't take any stand in such matters, or I'm not trained in such matters, or some other term, so as to dissociate himself from any thought of standing with Jerome on any matter of theology or of vital religion. It's simply admiring him as a man. Well, Poggio is typical of many of these humans. I read you at the end of the last hour a few statements from Mazzoli's book about the humanists who were prominent in the papal court. And this shows the development, shows very clearly the development in the papal court during this century. After March and 5th, got the council pushed aside to some extent and made a foundation, made a start in rebuilding Rome. And then Eugene IV, with his struggles against the Council of Basel, succeeded in getting the power pretty much all in the hands of the Pope. The next Pope, Nicholas V, is considered as the first of the humanist popes. Not that he was a humanist himself, but that he is one who greatly admired the human. And Nicholas V was interested in having the Vatican be a center like a court in a of an empire or of a king, where people would say, there are the most brilliant people. There are the people who are the brilliant thinkers and the intellectual leaders. And he delighted to hire as secretary people who were prominent humanists. And so this Poggio, who Mazzoli describes as the profligate author of an obscene joke book, and who dared to speak so in such praising terms of Jerome's character, even though carefully dissociating himself from Jerome's views, this Poggio was apostolic secretary under several popes, as Mazzoli points out here. And another papal secretary was Antonio Beccadilli, who wrote filthy poems, as he says it. And one who today it is hardest of all for present-day Romanists to think of as having been a prominent papal secretary is Lorenzo Valla, V-A-L-L-A. Lorenzo Valla, they find it difficult to think of as a papal secretary, not simply because he attacked Christian faith and advocated in his book, says McSorley, in his book on pleasure, the indulgence of every human appetite, and lived up to his own vicious theory. Not even because, as McSorley says, he ridicules scholastic philosophy and the religious life. But more particularly from the viewpoint of a present-day Romanist, Lorenzo Valla showed that the text of the Vulgate was defective and criticized the preservation of the text of the Vulgate and took up the Donation of Constantine, a document which was believed also Europe to be a genuine document by the Emperor Constantine giving the Pope Italy as a realm that he should own and control and direct and rule, and showed that on literary grounds that the Donation of Constantine was a forgery of several centuries after the time of Constantine. And Valla did such a good job of this, of proving this, that it came in his lifetime to be admitted by all that the Donation of Constantine was purely a forgery. No wonder that a century later, Martin Luther had Valla's work on this printed and distributed. Well, Valla did run into danger from the Inquisition at various times, but he was very clever in explaining away his statements and his attitude, and he was such an able man that the Pope kept him during part of his life as apostolic secretary. There were other men quite a large number of men who during these next these next number of decades in this century, had very prominent places at the papal court, who were great students of Greek and Latin, great hunters for minor things, great clever writers of dialogue. And they would, now this book that he says on pleasure, he says it attacked, advocated the indulgence of every human appetite. Now that is greatly condensed, the way McSorley says it. That isn't quite what the book does. What Valla does in this book is to represent three men as having an argument. And one of them is the man who argues for hedonism, for simply indulging in every human appetite to the extreme, and argues that is the right way to live life. And another one argues for some other type of life, and then one argues for a life of obedience to the church and living a moral life. And the three argue, and in the end, the one who stands for the church is recognized as the victor. But as you read what they say, you can't help feeling that it is the man who argues for hedonism who Valla has given the strongest argument to, and whom he has represented as the greatest thinker. And so the way that McSorley expresses it here, you wonder how any Pope could teach him as an apostolic secretary. Well, when you take the actual impact of his work, you feel that way. But when you take the way it was worded, it was cleverly worded, so that he could say, well, I'm just quoting the views of this type of man. I'm not advocating that myself at all. But there was a widespread development of thought and study during this century, and McSorley lists a large number of people of scholarly type, many of whom were men of profligate life, but some of whom were not. And there are some of these whom we will speak of in connection with the beginning of the next century, and one in particular whom we will speak of towards the end of the present century. So I'm only going to very briefly refer to him here. Anyone who's ever lived in Los Angeles is aware of Pico Street, P-I-C-O, Pico Street. I heard once somebody wrote a letter addressed to somebody, Pico Street, USA, and it was delivered in Los Angeles. I was told that this is the only Pico Street in Los Angeles. But the name Pico came from the early Spaniards to Los Angeles. There was a famous Pico family in Italy, which developed a branch in Spain. And this man was named Pico della Mirandola. P-I-C-O-D-E-L-L-A, capital M-I-R-A-N-D-O-L-A. And McSorley says of him, Tycho Della Mirandola was master of Greek, Latin, Syriac, and Arabic. And he was a man who, in his character, was very much superior to the bulk of these humanists, partly because of a great influence that came into his life that we will discuss a little later. He comes near the end of the century. And although he died as a fairly young man, he had a great influence on another one, which went on directly to another one, and very greatly influenced the Reformation. So we will speak about Tycho Della Mirandola before the end of this term, a little more at length. But I mention him here particularly to show that not all the humanists were men who were un-Christian by any means. Tycho Della Mirandola, at least in the latter part of his life, was a very earnest Christian. But now, this humanist development of this period, it brought into the church much of paganism. It brought in much of the pagan attitude you find in some of the great ancient classics, and much of the immoral and low attitudes that you find in certain places in the ancient Greek classics. There was great harm done by humanism, but also there was great good done in another way by humanism. The good that it did was to arouse interest in the study of the classics, in the study of ancient languages, to train, get men trained who were good in handling these things, and to prepare the way for the men like Martin Luther and John Calvin, who would be fully trained in the humanist learning and able to go right to the original of the scriptures in the Greek and the Hebrew, and to find exactly what it meant, and to show the incrustations and superstitions that had developed during the Middle Ages, and to sweep them away. So the humanist movement, while the individuals in it, some of them deserve great condemnation, and others of them considerable commendation, on the whole, they were not men of high character, but it was in a very real sense a preparation for the Reformation. And the without humanism preceding it, the Reformation either never would have come, or if it did come, would certainly have been very different from what it was when it actually came. It's interesting to think of Martin Luther when he was shut up in the Wartburg hiding, hidden away there for fear of that he was under order to be killed by the emperor. And they were hiding him in this castle up in the Wartburg. And while he was there waiting for some weeks till it would be safe for him to come out, he spent his time beginning his great translation of the New Testament from the original Greek into German, and made tremendous headway on it during those weeks when he was in hiding there in the Wartburg. And then when conditions in Wittenberg became so bad that they didn't know what to do under the circumstances, and they wished for the strong personality and able leadership of Luther, and yet they knew that if he went, there was great danger of his being seized and burned at the stake. But Luther, seeing how bad the situation was, decided that he would leave his safe hiding place and go back to Wittenberg. Knowing he had to pass through the territory of Duke George, one of his greatest enemies, and on the way, one day, he went disguised as a knight, and somebody saw a knight in one of the inns where he was eating his dinner at noon. As he sat there eating his dinner, he had his Hebrew Bible beside him and was reading from it as he ate. And they wondered how a knight could read Hebrew, and Luther's humanism, you might say, might have cost him his life on that particular case. But it shows how this was a tremendous part of what developed the Reformation, was the preparation of these men to be able to go right through the scriptures and not to have to say what some pope has said, or what some find of original writer perhaps has said, or what some translation has said, for no translation can be absolutely accurate, but to go right to the original and see just what it was. Yes? Yes. Yeah. It ended in 1835. Yes. 1835, the end of the incident. Yes. Well, So much then for the humanist, and we thank Mr. Werner for having called our attention to eight, which is the Spanish Inquisition. The Spanish Inquisition. We have already noticed the development of the Inquisition in order to root out the Albigenses. And that Inquisition succeeded completely in rooting out the Albigenses. But it meant that men with plenary authority to seize anyone whom they suspected, to use any method they desired in order to get facts against them, and not under any responsibility to bring witnesses, or to allow a man to be confronted with witnesses, or even to know what the charges against him were able to dispose of people ruthlessly. It was carried on all over Europe, and while its purpose was to deal with the Albigenses primarily, yet it branched out and dealt with many other things. And it was very extensive in the south of France, where the Albigenses had their great center. In other countries, it was much less extensive. In Germany, the Inquisitors didn't find so many Albigenses, so they set to work finding people accused of being witches. And they burned a great many so-called witches at the stake, and they destroyed many people on various accusations. But this Inquisition, while it continued steadily this right through up until within the last century, its greatest time was during its first century and a half of existence. And so it was on a comparatively lower key by this time. And the England had never permitted to enter into England. The Inquisition, that Inquisition never was actually in England. But now you've often, doubtless, most of you heard of the Spanish Inquisition. I would think that probably for every person that's ever heard of the Papal Inquisition, there are probably a dozen who've heard of the Spanish Inquisition. Because at least when I was a boy, it was constantly referred to in history books and in even in novels and all kinds of writings. But the Spanish Inquisition was a movement that was somewhat different from the regular Inquisition. In fact, it was so different that the attitude of most Romanist writers is to try to make out that the popes were not responsible for the Spanish Inquisition. That the Spanish Inquisition was a political thing handled by the kings of Spain, and McSorley will say that Pope repeatedly tried to modify it or to moderate it, or to persuade them not to be so severe in the Spanish Inquisition. Well, actually, that is not true, because the Spanish Inquisition was begun by a papal order. But it is true in this sense, that the Spanish Inquisition was a joint effort. It was begun by papal authority. It had papal authority all through. But it was at the request of Ferdinand of Aragon in Spain. Every American knows of Ferdinand and Isabella. Ferdinand of Aragon, Isabella of Castile, who united their two sections of Spain and thus made Spain a unified nation. But Ferdinand was very zealous against heresy, and he was anxious to root out heresy from Spain, but there was not a great amount of heresy in Spain. That was not, that certainly was sincere enough. But also, along with that, he had a political problem which he was facing, and that was the problem of the Jews in Spain. During the previous many centuries, Jews had been settled in Spain. During most of the Middle Ages, as you know, the Mohammedans held Spain. They called them the Moors. These were men from Morocco who held Spain in subjection and who had a very high civilization in Spain, actually higher than the Moorish civilization than the civilization of Europe at the same time during the Middle Ages. Well, they had extended a great measure of tolerance to the Jews, that is, Jews and Christians under Islam were given very considerable measure of freedom. They were not treated like heathen were, who were given the choice between the Quran and the sword. They were given higher taxes. They were subject to considerable disabilities. But on the whole, they were tolerated in the Muslim empire. And so in Spain, there had developed a group of many thousands, in fact, into the hundreds of thousands, of Jews who were not only very active in commerce, but prominent in all sorts of professional activities and in scholarship as well. And these Jews today, even to this day, a Jew who traces his ancestry to the Spanish Jews before 1500 is in a way an aristocrat among the Jews. These Jews had a higher standard of living, greater luxury available to them, a higher standard of scholarship, and even a somewhat different pronunciation than the pronunciation of the Jews in most other countries. And when they decided to revive Hebrew as a living language in modern Israel, they selected the pronunciation of the Spanish Jews as the type of pronunciation which they tried to follow, even though most of the leaders come from Germany or Poland, where the pronunciation was the Ashkenazi pronunciation rather than the Sephardi pronunciation as the Spanish Jews were called. Well, these Jews were in Spain under the Moors, and then when Spain was reconquered, they continued to be very active in Spanish life, and great efforts were made to convert them to Christianity. And these efforts were had a very slight measure of success. There were some conversions, not a great many. And then some of the Spanish rulers began trying forcibly to convert them to Christianity and to seize their property if they did not become Christians. And the results were that large numbers of these Jews had their children baptized and declared themselves to be Christians. But naturally, many of these who were only doing it for their own advancement or their own protection, many of them secretly were still actually Jews. And now under Frederick, there was a desire to root out these hidden Jews. And how great an extent this was a matter of his interest in the church, and to how great an extent it was a desire to seize the property of these Jews and to turn over to Spaniards the opportunities and positions they had, it is hard to say. Both motives doubtless entered into Ferdinand. But Ferdinand asked one of the popes in this century to give him authorization to start a new inquisition in Spain, an inquisition which would be different from the other inquisition, in that though carried on with papal authority, it would be carried on by church bishops or Dominicans or other leaders who were selected by the King of Spain and whose activity was to quite an extent under the direction of the King of Spain. Ferdinand ruled for many years. He was king from 1452 to 1516. Isabella was queen from 1451 to 1504. That's to say, he lived 12 years longer than she did. But during much of this time, they were joint rulers. But in 1480, the Spanish Inquisition was instituted, and it was directed primarily against the conversos, that is, those Jews who were nominally Christians. They are sometimes called conversos. More commonly, they are called Maranos, M-A-R-A-N-O. And so the Inquisition set about to discover who were those who were really Jews while claiming to be Christian. And the first public display of the work of the Spanish Inquisition was held in February 6, 1481. And there they burned 6 men and women publicly at this first so-called auto de fe. But before long, they were having far larger numbers. They gave out an announcement at the beginning of the Spanish Inquisition of an edict of grace, which gave heretics a period of 30 or 40 days in which to announce themselves, and on making confession, assured them of pardon. Now that sounded very nice. But what it amounted to was that if they were pardoned, if they confessed and were pardoned, they were not killed, but they were subject to great disability through the rest of their life, unable to hold any political position, forced to march through the city carrying candles and bareheaded and making public signs of their regret and remorse for what they had done, but more important than this, forced to reveal the names of other heretics. And if they failed to reveal the names of other heretics, probably seized and tortured in order to compel them to do so. And so very soon there were great numbers of these people who were being seized, and many of them were being burnt at the stake. We don't know the complete number, but it certainly ran into many thousands. And these auto de fe, as they called them, were great public occasions on which all the people of the neighborhood were expected to be present and to observe. And the people who had been convicted and who had been tortured to reveal the names of others were brought to the public display and had to sit there while there was long proceedings with sermons and discussions and presentations before they would finally be brought forward. And if they had finally abjured their heresy, then they would be strangled before being burnt. While if they had not, then they would be burnt alive. And it was one of the most terrible things in the history of the world, perhaps. This Spanish Inquisition, which was developed under the leadership of Ferdinand of Aragon, and which continued until 1835, when it finally was brought to an end. Now, the bulk of the people whom it dealt with were Marranos, that is, men whose ancestors had been Jews, and who themselves had been found failing to eat pork on some occasion where it was served, skipping it by on some excuse or other, or failing to abstain from work on Saturday, or doing something else which somebody took as evidence to report them to the Inquisition. It's no wonder that when Protestantism began, the Spanish Inquisition being in full sway, it was quite easy to root it out of Spain. There was a very good start of Protestantism in Spain, because the Emperor Charles V, who was Emperor of Germany, was also King of Spain. And some of his soldiers took Luther's writings with them to Spain, and they would take sometimes right in the court of the King of Spain, there would be a cover of a book, of some devotional book. Here'd be the cover, and then inside it would be stuck one of Luther's works. And a man would sit in the court reading this, and you could see the cover and see that it was a good recognized devotional book, or maybe a salacious novel or something that wouldn't arouse any criticism. But inside there would be one of Luther's works, and the man would be reading it. And little groups of Protestants developed through Spain before the Inquisition caught on to the fact that it caused them to come into Spain, since there had been no prominent leader who had espoused it. But once they caught on to it, then it was mercilessly and completely wiped out. Mr. McCarty?
Yeah.
Yes. No. The term Marano was applied to all converted Jews. All converted Jews were Maranos, converted Moors were Moriscos. And that was just a term applied to all of them. But there were thousands, in fact, tens of thousands of them. But their neighbors were encouraged to watch them to see if they saw any sign that they still were Jews at heart. And if they found them, reported to the Inquisition. And when they get two or three reports on one person, he would be seized in the middle of the night and tortured to confess. And of course, some were exonerated, but that was rare. And they would be forced to confess the names of others. And we should mention, though, that in 1492, Torquemada, the very year in which America was discovered, Torquemada, the infamous head, first head of the Spanish Inquisition, found that the Jewish influence in Spain was still very great. There were, of course, the Inquisition was not allowed to touch anybody who was a Jew outward. A man was a Jew, he could carry on his Jewish services, he was a Jew, the Inquisition had nothing to do with him. The Inquisition dealt with men who pretended to be Christian, or who were Christian. It had no right to touch a man who was actually a Jew. And still there were some hundreds of thousands, at least 100,000 Jews in Spain, and in 1492, Torquemada persuaded Ferdinand to give an order for the expulsion of all Jews from Spain. And so in 1492, the Jews were ordered to leave Spain. Most of their property was seized by the Spanish government, and people, there was great suffering and deprivation as these people were forced out of the country. And a great many of them went to the Turkish Empire, where they were tolerated to quite an extent and allowed to, though they were pretty hard up when they got there, they were given opportunities to get ahead in the Turkish Empire. And many of them settled there, others went in different areas. But the Spanish Jews, the Sephardis, maintained their identity as opposed to the Ashkenazi Jews, the German or Polish Jews, right to the present day. Yes? It's pretty hard to prove. The proceedings of the Inquisition were secret, and it'll be very hard to know. There doubtless were all kinds among them. There were those who were earnest Jews, but who for safety's sake pretended to be Christian, and then there were those who weren't particularly interested in religion, and who perhaps liked to cling to some of the old customs of their ancestors. And then there doubtless were some who people just coveted their property and used an excuse to get a hold of. Yes, sir? Yeah. 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 Well, this was at the very beginning of the Inquisition, the Edict of Grace. They said, we are going to have an Inquisition to wipe out heresy. But they said, before we do, we are giving 40 days in which any heretic can come forward, confess his error. If he has been a heretic, he desires to recant it and become a sound believer, and he will be forgiven. And that was just that was just a temporary thing.
And then after that, if they didn't confess before the 34 days,
well, it would depend on the whole situation, of course. I mean, there were individuals who were released. Ignatius Loyola, who founded the Jesuit order, was three times arrested by the Inquisition because he had his idea of starting an order which is different from anything they had before. And it's the great mainstay of the Roman Catholic Church today is the Jesuits. But Ignatius Loyola was a Spaniard who had a new idea of an order, and he proceeded on his own lines and getting people about him. And three times he was seized by the Inquisition and he was examined. But he was able to prove to them that he had no heretical tendencies or attitudes. But I don't know how many there were that were able to do that. He probably was more skillful than most and had a wider knowledge, too. But he had a struggle before he succeeded, and eventually he became the leader of the greatest force against heresy within the Protestant, within the Roman Catholic Church. But there were a few who were acquitted, but as a rule, they were convicted, but the convictions, maybe a fifth of those convicted were burnt. And then some would be imprisoned for life, and some would have various types of disabilities or punishments and so on. It varied. Varied with the different inquisitors and the different situations. But in 1492, all those who were not Muranos, but actually Jews, were expelled from the country, from Spain. And they have continued their identity to the present day as a distinct group and as a somewhat more cultured and more able group on the average than the others. Although, of course, there are many from the German and Polish group who have shown tremendous ability in various lines. But this Spanish Inquisition, as you see, was right there, actively present when Protestantism came into Spain. And the result was that when it came, it wiped it out very quickly. There is a book that my wife and I picked up a few years ago called The Spanish Brothers. It is a novel written by a Christian writer but describing a family in Spain which begins to adopt, to study the Bible and to adopt Protestant ideas and describes their winning others and so on, and they go on for a time without interference, and then it describes how the Inquisition comes in, and it describes most vividly the different types of inquisitors. It describes those who it was simply was their job and their way to get ahead, their advancement, and who were not serious in it, and then it describes the others who were real fanatics. And it gives a very vivid picture. It's one of the most interesting books of type I've ever read, this book, The Spanish Brothers. And I think a very inspiring book, too, to see the courage with which these people described in it stood true to the Lord in those situations. Now, Spain has a considerable part in our interest in this particular century, because although the French influence was to quite an extent removed from the papacy, with the it's going back to Rome and the new popes appointing Italian cardinals more, when previously the majority of the cardinals had generally been French, during this century, there was one Spaniard who was elected pope. And this Spaniard, about the middle of the century, who was pope for only a very few years, is not of any particular interest to us, except for the fact that during a brief time that he was pope, he appointed his relatives to very important positions. And, well, most of the popes did that, but this brought in his family into a prominent position. And one of those whom he brought in was his nephew, Rodrigo. This pope was Callista III, 1455 to 1458. As you see, 3 years. He was elected at the age of 77 when the two Italian groups couldn't agree, and they both had a strong force, so they elected an old man to fill in for a few years until one or other group got the supremacy. But Callista III, the successor of Nicholas V, appointed his nephew, Rodrigo Borgia, as a cardinal, a very young man at the time, but a very able man. And 35 years later, Rodrigo became pope. And he has the worst reputation of any pope in all history. I don't mean he was as bad as the Pope of the 9th and 10th century that we looked at, although it's hard to prove he was any better than they were. But he was a much more able man than they were. This was the Spanish family of Borgia. And the name of Borgia has become very well known ever since for the activities of this Pope, who became Pope through having been made a cardinal by his uncle 35 years earlier. So we look at him tomorrow.